Happy Friday, everyone. Thank you, first of all, every one of you who have been helping keep this program on the air. If there's anyone else that wants to help them in this, it's easy to do. Just write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's program. Then send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and that will be applied to the radio broadcast fees. Friday, I also urge you, as a believer in Jesus Christ, a believer in His Word, not to neglect the assembling together of the saints. Everyone needs a home congregation, everybody needs a home church, and they need to be constantly part of that community of believers, so that you will worship and fellowship and pray and praise and study and serve and encourage as God intended. And so if you don't have a home church like that, where you're doing that every Lord's Day and multiple days beyond that, then you need to go out and find a place where you can do all those things. If you happen to be looking right now, and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, please give us a look over. Maybe we can be the part of God's grand church where you can kind of settle down and help. Let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 27 and continue with the story of Jacob now. We'd been kind of looking at the story of Yitzhak, but it is very quickly turned into the story of Jacob. And we know that Jacob, at his mother's prompting, deceived his father, Yitzhak, into giving him the blessing of Abraham. The way that he carried it out was because his father was blind. He pretended to be Esau, taking on the skin of a goat on his arms and on his neck in order to, and to wear his brother's clothing so that when his father got close to him and touched him and smelled him, he would think he was Esau and give him the blessing. And in their culture, once the words of blessing were pronounced over someone in a very formal ceremony, they were irrevocable. They can't be called back. And so when we finished up last time, Esau had realized that he was not going to be the heir of Jacob, Yitzhak anymore, that he was not going to receive the Abrahamic blessing, that Jacob had taken that. And Esau was comforting himself with the idea that once Yitzhak had died, which they all believed at this moment that it was any day now he would do that, that once dad was dead, he would murder Jacob and thereby have the blessing and the birthright revert back to him as the only remaining son. Now, not the most logical thinking in the world, but he was thinking from resentment and rage. And I suggested to you as we're closing out that he probably shared all this information, all this emotion with his two wives. And of course, because of the way things are set up in that time period, his two wives would have had regular contact with their mother-in-law, Rebecca, who is the queen of the encampment. She is the boss of everything that goes on in the encampment. And with Yitzhak kind of laid up right now, not doing well, she pretty much calls the shots through the whole encampment. And so they would have had regular conversations with her, and I think they may have either intentionally or just incidentally passed on Esau's murderous intentions to mom. Verse 42. The words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son. And remember again, there's like only a few seconds between them. When they came out of the womb together, Esau came out all red and hairy, and Jacob had hold of his foot. And so they came out very close together. But the younger and older part keeps coming into the story here. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother, in Haran." So a couple of weeks' journey to the north, up past the bend in the Euphrates, up to the place where she came from. And stay with him for a while until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. Why should I be bereft of you both in one day? Now, she is thinking through this a little bit farther than what Esau is. It is, I think, pretty clear that Esau thought that by murdering Jacob after dad's death, that all of the things would revert to him as the only surviving son. But the reality is, if he intentionally, with premeditation, kills Jacob, he will become a murderer, and the community of the tent city will be required to condemn him as a murderer, and the penalty for murder is execution. And so she thinks through this whole thing. If Esau were to murder you, Jacob, it wouldn't be very long after that that he would be executed, and then I'd lose both my boys. So why should I let that happen? I'm going to step in and help the situation. Now, she's tried already to help the situation, and that's how the situation like this got started. But this time, it seems more reasonable. And that is basically, let's get you away from your brother's day-to-day interaction and let him chill. Let him cool off. Let him get past this emotion. Then when that happens, I'll bring you back and everything will be okay. So how is she going to accomplish this? Because even though she's kind of running the day-to-day operations, it is Yitzhak, who's still alive and mentally functional, that is got to call the shots for getting Jacob to leave and go up north. So Rebekah said to Yitzhak, "I loathe my life because of the Hittite women." So she says, "I can't stand living another day with these Canaanite daughters-in-law." We talked about the idea that when Esau got married when he was 40, and that's been 37 years ago now, understand that Jacob and Esau are about 77 at this point. When Esau married first one, and then another Canaanite woman, he was marrying outside the faith. It wasn't an ethnicity issue. It was a religion issue. And so those women brought their false faith into the tent city. And as they're raising kids, those kids are getting an education from both grandpa and grandma, hopefully dad, that is about the true and living God, the creator God, the God of Abraham and Isaac, And they're getting that, but they're also getting education of the Canaanites gods, you know, like Baal, the thunder and lightning and rain god, and Asherah, the goddess of fertility and grain and babies. And so she is really upset about that. Both Yitzhak and Rebekah were upset by that. And so that's why she says next, if Jacob marries one of the Hittite women like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? So basically, if Jacob ends up marrying one of these local girls, one of these pagan women, everything's lost. We'll lose our grandkids to paganism. And so what's she basically saying? She's saying, we need to do something about that. We got to make sure that Jacob meets a young woman of marriageable age that believes in the one true God. And there ain't none of them around here. And Yitzhak takes the hint. Chapter 28, Yitzhak called Yaakov and blessed him. This is a different blessing. This is a blessing go and get a wife. And directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Padan Aram. Now, Aram is the name of the region north of the Promised Land, on both sides of the Euphrates River, there by the bend. So pretty much everything north of, probably the waters of Merom, which is a little bit north of the Sea of Galilee. That line northward to the Euphrates River, and then northward from there up to the mountains, that's all known as Aram. And the people who live there are called Arameans. We refer to the area as Syria in later Bible versions. Padan means the expanse or the open plain. And so he's got a very specific place in Aram in mind. It's basically, I think it's the Balik drainage area north of Euphrates. They're at the bend. So we're talking about all the region of Ur of the Chaldees and Haran, the place from which Abraham and Sarah moved to the Promised Land. So arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. So basically, we want you to go up north and marry one of your cousins. Now, that's not a problem. We've talked about this multiple times, and I'm going to repeat it again. Way back in time, the gene pool of humanity was much deeper and wider. And so it did not matter if you married fairly close relatives because the genes had not deteriorated enough that you wanted to avoid matching the same gene pool elements together. Eventually, by the time of Moses, it had gotten polluted enough that God put a warning that you were not to marry close relatives like half-brothers, half-sisters. They still allowed the cousin thing back then. Nowadays, we know enough about genetics. You don't want to marry cousins because of problems that might pop up into the kids. All right, so here, not a problem. Go marry your cousin. Listen, though, to the religious aspect of this. Verse number 3. God Almighty bless you. So the literal Hebrew is El Shaddai, which I've told you before, Shad has to do with the chest muscles or the breast. Some people had thought that this is a reference to God being super strong because he's got lots of chest muscle. But the Greek-speaking Hebrews of the 3rd century BC, when they're writing this, they took it more of the bosom idea, the best bud, the close friend, bosom buddy, you know. And so they said, my God, the God of my chest, my personal God. So I believe that's exactly what Jacob says here. My God will bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you that you may become a company of peoples. Now that's just a repeating of the Abrahamic blessing, the seed blessing that has already been poured on him in the ceremony earlier. Verse number 4, may he give the blessing of Abraham to you and to your seed with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings that God gave to Abraham. So this is all a reminder to him that you need to go and get married and start having kids so that you can realize the blessings of God through Abraham, through Isaac, can start happening in you, so that all the world may be blessed through your seed, and that this land that we're living in temporarily will become the permanent home of a multitude of your offspring. So that's what he's doing, is saying, you need to leave here, go up there, marry a cousin, start having kids. Now, I think it's implied here that Yitzhak also believes that it's a good idea for him to leave his brother's presence for a while and let his brother cool down. I don't know if Yitzhak had been told by Rebecca what Esau was planning, but it's still a good idea all around to put these boys in separate corners for a while. Keep them 2 weeks travel away from each other until things can kind of settle down. It will become obvious, so let me say it now, that the in-between the lines evidence is that Jacob is sent away with nothing, probably as a bit of a punishment for having deceived his father. Because if his father had not been deceived and he was leaving here under good circumstances to go up north in order to get a wife from his cousins, then most likely they would have sent camels full of goodies and presents and dowry items in order to help him in this journey. But he has done something that was totally inappropriate by deceiving his father. And so his penalty seems to be, yeah, you go up and find yourself a wife, but you do it with nothing as a starter. Nothing but the clothes on your back, the sandals on your feet, and the staff in your hand. The reason I picked all that is because that's the way Jacob describes his own situation when he left home. All right, verse number 5. Thus, Yitzhak sent Yaakov away. He went to Padan Aram to Laban, the son of Betuel, the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mother. And so he is now heading out on what could be up to a 2 week walk north. But before we move into his story, let's do a little bit more Esau, how about? Now Esau saw that Yitzhak had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. So Dad very specifically said, Jacob, I don't want you marrying any of these local Canaanite girls. Esau realizes just how much that mattered to his father at that point. And there might have been debates and arguments earlier. Like I said, about 37 years earlier is when Esau had married his first Canaanite wife. Yitzhak and Rebekah might have objected and said, don't you dare marry outside the faith. Don't you dare marry a Canaanite woman. They might have even offered, why don't you go up north and marry one of your cousins who believes in the true God? But whatever the background, Esau had settled down and married first one and then another Canaanite. And it had caused nothing but trouble with his mother and father. And so now that he sees his brother heading north to get married to a cousin because he was told not to marry a Canaanite woman, something is moved inside of Esau that he wants to regain his father's approval. I'm not so sure he's ready to try to gain his mother's approval. Remember that the scripture has been pretty plain that Jacob was loved by mom. They spent most of their time together. And Esau was loved by dad. And so now Esau thinks, man, maybe if I'd married in the faith, my dad would have loved me more. And so what does he do? Verse 7, and that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and gone to Padan Aram. So when Esau saw that the Canaanite women did not please Yitzhak, his father, notice mom's not mentioned, Esau went to Ishmael. Now, Ishmael, not the man, but the people group. The man, Uncle Ishmael, had died about 13 or 14 years earlier. And so he goes to his uncle's family, and he took as his wife, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Yishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth. So as I already said, Esau is about, he's about, 77, something like that, when this story happens. He's been married 37 years to his Canaanite wife. We don't know how old this woman is. She seems to be the baby of the family. Her dad's already dead for 13 or 14 years, and she's still unmarried. So he marries her thinking that Ishmael certainly worships the one true God. And by marrying her, he's marrying into the faith. And that maybe this will reverse the disapproval of dad. It won't. there's still a problem here. Because now he's not got just simply two Canaanite wives. He's got three wives total. And, of course, the original intention of God is one man, one woman together for a lifetime. Now, it might pop in your head at this point, why didn't Yitzhak and Rebekah just marry Jacob off to Mahalath? Because she is, obviously, in the faith of Abraham, in that line of Ishmael that believes in the one true God at this point. And my answer is, because it's not just about marrying in the faith locally, it's about getting him out of the local region for a period of time. And so just a day or two south is not far enough. They wanted him totally out of the region. Let's really set the stage for our next story now. So verse 10 says, Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. So Haran is his destination. As I said, it's about 2 weeks' walk, depending on, you know, how long you walk every day and whether or not you take off some days along the way. But he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Now, we'll find out very shortly that this is at what will eventually be called Bethel, which is, I think, 15 or so miles north of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is about a day's travel north of Hebron. And Hebron is about a day's travel north and east of Beersheba. So for all practical purposes, this is probably the third day of his travel since leaving home that he comes to this place. Verse 11, he came to a certain place and he stayed there the night because the sun had set. Now, he may not have known it, although it's possible he could have, that this is basically the place where his grandfather Abraham set up his second encampment in the Promised Land and put an altar up and worshiped God and lived for a while. But here he is stopping at this special site. And he has nothing but the clothes on his back and the shoes on his feet and the staff in his hands. So taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. So he's living rough. And the only thing that he has for a pillow is a nice, big, smooth stone.